This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 138.
We were somehow going to have to figure out how we were going to implement new technology, update our processes, really just work differently while still executing on what the business needed. Ultimately, the way we were able to do that was shifting to that product mindset, thinking about delivering in a different way, which was creating these, using the agile practices to drive 2-week sprints, and then working differently as a team. Really did transform the talent acquisition organization and the way we work.
There's a quote from Albert Einstein that's always guided my approach, and I want to make sure people understand what I'm talking about so they're not confused of what simple means. But the quote is, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. So really the focus is on clarity, efficiency, and not oversimplification, with the result being losing meaning or actual functionality of whatever you're doing. And for me, simplicity means scalability.
After we've kicked this off, just in the last 3 or 4 months, we surveyed rehires that joined again. What was interesting is the reason they left is often the reason they returned.
Welcome to a special episode of the Future of HR Podcast. Today, we're launching an exciting new series called Next Gen Disruptors. This series focuses on next gen HR leaders who are making a difference in their organizations with their innovative approaches and they're delivering impressive results. And today, we're lucky to have 3 forward-looking HR leaders sharing the great work they're doing in talent acquisition and learning development. First, you're going to hear from Jennifer Van Eersel, Global Head of Talent Acquisition at Pacific Life. She's going to take us behind the scenes and detail how she and her team have been using agile talent acquisition practices to deliver exceptional results over the last 4 years. If you've ever been thinking about implementing agile talent practices on your team, this conversation's for you. Next, Joshua Rimorowski, who is the VP of Learning Development at SRS Distribution, will discuss his customer-centric approach to developing talent. Joshua emphasizes keeping frontline workers and those closest to the customers at the heart of learning program development. I think you'll learn a lot from Joshua's secret sauce for L&D, which is to make learning simple, fun, and directly related to the job. And last but not least, we'll hear from Peter Price, who leads talent acquisition, brand, and marketing at Providence Health System. Peter and his team have developed a targeted boomerang hiring program that has generated over 5,000 hires in the last 2 years. In our conversation with Peter, he's going to share the strategies and the lessons learned behind this remarkable recruiting engine. And since this is our inaugural Next Gen Disruptors episode, I would love your feedback. Let me know if you enjoy this format and if you want me to search out and bring on more Next Gen HR leaders in our field. And with that, let's jump into my conversation with Jennifer on agile talent acquisition practices. Jennifer, welcome to the Future of HR Podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Really excited to hear about what you're doing at Pacific Life and how you have taken agile methodologies to really build out talent acquisition, which I think is awesome. Tell us more about what led you and the team to move to implement an agile TA process.
Just about everything starts with a problem we have to solve. This is actually back in 2019. We were about to kick off a 5-year strategy for the organization. And a big piece of that was digital transformation. And we really had 2 problems to solve. We had to hire a bunch of tech talent to drive digital transformation. And we had to transform talent acquisition ourselves. And that was really about how were we going to be able to accelerate the hiring process and leverage new tools in order to do that digital transformation hiring. So those were the 2 things we were trying to accomplish. And as part of that, I started exploring. I was talking to some of our IT folks, one of them, which was a scrum master. And she said to me, have you ever thought of agile practices? I'm like, how does that work? Isn't that just for software development? She said, no, it could be applied to anything you do. You just really have to change your mindset and think about what you're trying to deliver and the value you're bringing to the business. So that's how we started to explore it.
That is awesome.
Just so we're clear, maybe describe a little bit more about what Agile TA means at Pacific Life, just so everyone is listening, because not everyone has done Agile in product management or tech, and they certainly, most people have not done it for TA.
Traditionally, it is leveraged mostly in tech, and some folks think about Agile as just a way of thinking or a way of operating, but we're using it truly in the methodology, the Agile practices like software developers do, but we have applied it to talent acquisition. Agile practices is really a project management approach that emphasizes planning, prioritization, iteration, transparency, collaboration, and reviews. This approach has enabled our TA team to drive continuous improvement and execute on hiring initiatives at the same time. And that's the trick. When we started this strategy, we weren't given unlimited resources and unlimited time. We were somehow going to have to figure out how we were going to implement new technology, update our processes, really just work differently while still executing on what the business needed. Ultimately, the way we were able to do that was shifting to that product mindset, thinking about delivering in a different way, which was creating these, using the Agile practices to drive two-week sprints, and then working differently as a team. We could break down silos, we could see the visibility of work across the entire team, and the team had input to everything that we were doing because we were talking to each other daily through our daily stand-ups and then reviewing all the work that we were producing on a two-week basis. Really did transform the talent acquisition organization and the way we work.
Oh, that's really interesting. And it sounds like really incredible. And your leadership had to be instrumental because this doesn't just sort of happen on its own. So you're pretty committed to this, I'm guessing. It probably took some like time to get used to. Like, how do you start to change to a two-week sprint from a traditional project management or even a TA process? Talk to us about what that was like, that transition period a little bit.
It wasn't easy. And the team wasn't initially on board or didn't understand why we were doing this. I started small. So I even took an agile approach to implementing agile. I started small with the TA leaders and introduced the methodology. And it was a lot to take in because it's a whole new language we had to adjust to. We use different tools. So we use Azure DevOps to keep our backlog and to facilitate our sprints and ultimately all the metrics to see what we are accomplishing. But we had to balance learning this new way of working and executing on our day-to-day recs. So it was mostly initially the project work that got into or moved over into the agile practices. And then we were still executing on recs, but eventually we pulled in any kind of big hiring initiatives were created in our backlog, and then were also prioritized and managed through our sprints. But it was quite the transition. In the first year, like I said, we started with the talent acquisition leaders and then expanded it to the broader team. And the feedback, and which I know we're going to talk a little bit more about, but the feedback was really incredible to see that transformation.
It sounds like it was really, really successful. And so that's helpful to understand. You took an agile approach and started small. And we're mainly focused on some of the TA projects. There's a lot of projects across TA, whether we're talking it's implementing new systems, new dashboards, employee branding, right? There's always a lot of projects that are happening. And as you start to move the recs in, how do you think about that in terms of, is that a product or a deliverable?
Yeah, as part of us optimizing the way we work, we went through a process of identifying what types of recs. So whether that be high volume recs, critical skill recs, or officer or professional level recs. And we really defined what that was first and then decided what needed to have the visibility across the team that we would pull into the sprints. Or another example would be there is a class of, say, 20 to fill. And we know there's got to be certain things that happen within that two-week sprint in order to hit that class deadline in order to make those hires.
Wow, that's so cool. That's helpful. Now, I think we kind of understand what you've been working on. So let's talk a little more about the methodology, because the shift from traditional TA to an agile TA methodology requires new ways of working, really a mindset shift like you talked about. So talk more about how the team had to start thinking and working differently in Agile TA, what the pushback or the initial reaction was compared to where you are today?
So initially, it was thinking about the value we were bringing to the customer, and the customer being really three areas: the hiring manager, the candidate, and then ourselves. We treated those three and measured it of what were the outcomes we were trying to drive for. So those three customers. And then we needed to think about not being perfect, and that we were going to use an iterative process to create a minimal viable product, which we call MVP, in order to deliver. And that really, that shift in mindset enabled us to create the agility across the team. It was a process. I would say it took us probably the first year to really get into shifting in that mindset and being comfortable creating that MVP, and then also thinking about executing, but also failing, that we would want to fail fast in order to improve. So when you're creating an MVP, it isn't going to be perfect, and it might not even be right at all. And we have to be able to test and learn in order to ultimately get to the right place. And those 2-week sprints enabled us to do that, so we could fail fast and then move on to the right solution.
That's really impressive, actually. I feel like a lot of times in HR and really just working in corporations in general, we don't want to fail. We don't want to have an MVP, right? We're always looking for perfection and try to have the perfect project plan versus like, hey, we're going to try this and see if it works. Right. Can give us an example of what an MVP looked like in the TA world, or one that you kind of remember that the team learned a lot from?
Yeah. A good one was we implemented a new technology. It was a pre-recorded video interview capability. When we implemented it, we thought every TA partner should use that technology, regardless of the type of rec it was, because we thought we were going to gain so many efficiencies from it that everyone should use it. And so that was a great example of literally making every TA partner using it and figuring out that is not working. And we were able to leverage that approach in the sprints to say, okay, well, this was our MVP. Now we need to customize and understand where we can leverage that technology, where it's going to be effective and where it isn't. And we had the data behind it, and we're able to review that in our 2-week sprints and decide how we were going to shift, and then also how to optimize it. We found there was a lot of managers who weren't doing the introduction, that when we knew if they did the introduction, we were more likely going to get that candidate to complete that video interview. But it was all that feedback in those sprints that we got from the team. So we were able to quickly pivot, make the improvements, and optimize the tool.
Let's talk a little more about the sprint, because I think that might be a concept that's new to some people not familiar with Agile. Because right now I'm thinking, this may sound like a lot of work. Like, wow, Jennifer's team doing sprints, they're doing MVPs. Like, how are they getting recs closed? That's what I think some TA leaders might be asking. But tell us more about what a sprint is, and then I want to talk more about the other components of Agile.
So the sprint is a 2-week, and you can adjust it, it depends on the team. But for us, it's a 2-week time frame in which we identify the specific work that we want to accomplish. And we always talk about right-sizing the work. So we want to be clear that it needs to be work that can be completed within 2 weeks. And some of the work that needs to be completed might be complex, or it might require a lot of collaboration, maybe outside of talent acquisition. So you really have to be planful. So a lot of people, when they think about Agile, they don't think about planning. And I would say just the opposite. It's actually probably more planning than you're ever doing prior to that. So you're really thoughtful about what can be accomplished, and you're realistic so that you are actually executing on that work within the 2 weeks. So it's a 2-week time period that you're executing on work, and then you're going into the next sprint and planning and figuring out what is next in order to deliver that MVP.
That's great. And another key principle is the product roadmap. Talk to us a little more about the TA roadmap and how you use that to drive results.
Our product roadmap is driven by our business strategy. We start with the business strategy. Obviously, then we have the HR strategy and the TA strategy. So that's how we populate our roadmap. But we are in complete alignment with what our talent acquisition value proposition is, and then the objectives and key results we want to accomplish. And then that gets populated into what we call our product roadmap or our backlog that guides us throughout the year. The wonderful thing about agile practices is we know things change and priorities change in the business. Having the ability to plan every 2 weeks allows us to reprioritize. So if something does change in the business, we're quickly able to pivot our resources and push other projects if we need to. It's a critical part, and it's also about delivering for the customer. What are we achieving for the customer as far as supporting their ability to hire quality talent?
And another component of Agile is a retrospective. Tell us more about what a retro is and how the team uses that to just get better.
So retrospectives are at the end of the two-week sprint, and it is there to help us be more effective at the sprint. So we want to know, at the beginning of when we implemented Agile practices, it was very much about, okay, how effective were we in the sprint? Did we plan appropriately? Did we consider the time it was going to take to incorporate other people as part of the work we were trying to get done? So it really just helped us individually improve our ability to leverage Agile practices. But I would say as we've gotten more mature in our practices, we use retros all the time for many different things. So it could be anything from getting feedback on maybe something new that we've done. And we want to know, did everyone like it? Did they think it worked? It could also be a year-end review where we want to take some time to acknowledge what everybody's accomplished. And so it ultimately is a nice platform where we can provide our thoughts and give everyone some kudos around what they've been doing. So you can use it in many different ways. And that's the beauty about Agile is it really, you can really make it work for what you need. It's not rigid. And that's what we've seen. We've been doing this now for 4 years. And our Agile practices have changed. It doesn't look exactly the same from where we started 4 years ago.
It's awesome. And think about as you bring new team members on, right? You probably have grown or has some team member changes in that time period.
Yeah.
Do they give you a look like, hey, what planet are you from? And what are you doing here? Pacific Life? It's so different than maybe other TA teams. How have you kind of brought people on to the Agile methodology?
Yeah. So we did learn. And yes, we definitely got those looks. But what we have done differently is we added that into our job descriptions so that we're not surprising anyone when they're joining the talent acquisition team that, and we talk about it through the interview process, but we do take the time to invest in our people. So for example, I have 2 Scrum Masters on my team. So we've invested in the formal training. Those individuals are responsible to help bring our new folks along on the journey and get them integrated. Because it, like I said, it does take some time and the language and getting familiar with the approach. And there are people who didn't like it and had opted out. So it isn't for everyone. But when you see the results, it's amazing to see what the team can accomplish and be involved with. And I think it also gives them a lot of variety in their work, because we know day in and day out of fill-in requisitions sometimes can be a thankless job. The participation in the projects that we do and ultimately how it's helping the talent acquisition team more broadly be successful is amazing to see that accomplishment.
Well, speaking of results, tell us a little more about some of the key wins or successes of the team over the last 4 years moving to this agile approach.
I'd say 3 things stand out. Number one is just delivering on our hiring goals. We've seen incredible acceleration of our hiring practices as a result of all of our process improvements. And this is kind of my second one, is just leveraging new technology. We have several examples of implementing new technology platforms, but also kind of homegrown processes, whether it's just leveraging Microsoft Forms or Power BI through our dashboards. The team in general, I would say, is very innovative. They're able to make those contributions. So when they have ideas, we're able to put those into the backlog and get them implemented. They don't sit on the shelf for 2 years. And then lastly, I would say high engagement scores across the entire TA team. This practice, agile practices, were implemented when COVID hit. So in 2020, actually 2020 was the first year we started doing agile practices, and it truly brought the team together, and that has continued. I have a team now across the world, and they are so engaged, and I think a lot of it's attributed to how we work.
Yeah, it's amazing. It just seems like it's so collaborative. Everyone's got visibility. There's a clear deliverables and what you're working on. And it seems like it's very powerful for TA teams to consider. So Jennifer, you think about, do you have one or two practical tips for other TA leaders or HR leaders who want to implement this in their organizations? Where should they start?
First, individuals should reach out to a Scrum Master in their technology organization and learn about agile practices and see how it works and see if they've had examples of agile practices outside of technology. And then also, if there is a decision to move forward with it, I would say invest in the education of your team and iterate. This will evolve and you can really customize it to align with what you're trying to achieve in your talent acquisition organization.
That's great. Really good tips. I hope people go out and try to do this. I think it's really a powerful way for all organizations in HR to think about this, besides just TA, but TA, it's really, really awesome what you guys have done. Jennifer, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Probably no surprise what I'm going to say, but I would say agility. There's so much happening, and I think we see this year over year. There's something new, whether it be Gen AI or new technology coming across. We think about kind of the customer experience. Agility is just so key. There's always going to be something new. And if we're not agile and we can't adapt, we're going to fall behind. So I really think agility is the key word for me.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Jennifer. Agility is your word, but agile TA is what you've been doing and doing a great job at that. So hopefully people reach out to you on LinkedIn if they have any questions.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you for being on the Future of HR podcast.
Thank you.
Are you ready to take your career to the next level? If you are, then you need to download the HR Leaders Blueprint, featuring battle-tested strategies from over 100 HR thought leaders and CHROs. This comprehensive 18-page guide delivers actionable steps, strategic frameworks, and real-world insights to elevate your impact. No theoretical fluff, just proven tactics to becoming a business-focused HR leader. And the best part, it's completely free. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And if you want to get a jumpstart on your 2025 career goals, then you do not want to miss out on the HR Leaders Blueprint. Thanks again to Jennifer. That was a terrific conversation, and it's so impressive how her and her team have adopted and utilized Agile TA for the last 4 years. Truly, truly inspirational. Next up is Joshua from SRS Distribution, and he's going to share his unconventional career journey and how that has shaped his thinking and driven his success as a talent leader.
Joshua, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
Oh, good, JP.
I'm excited to have you and be part of our Next Gen Disruptor series. You've had a really interesting career because it's not so much an untraditional career path, but you really started your career on the front lines. First as a FedEx driver, driving some, I think, a 26-foot truck. I'm not even sure what we call that. And then you worked your way up at a Verizon call center, but now you lead learning development for SRS Distribution, which is a $10 billion company. Tell us more about how this your career journey evolved from frontline to now talent and learning development executive.
That's a question for me I've always enjoyed reflecting on when people ask me, because my career has been anything but traditional, just especially in this HR and talent landscape. But I grew up in a blue collar, low income household, and really the focus was always on hard work as the core value, a way of life. And that work ethic for me really carried into my early years and in my career decisions. It directly impacted my decision, you know, to go work in the front lines, because that was the number one value system that was created, you know, for me and my life and growing up. And as I was doing those jobs in the front lines, and I realized pretty early on that hard work alone is a road to nowhere. So all that tough guy stuff that I grew up around alone wasn't enough. You need to be adaptable. You need to be curious. And I stumbled upon a Stephen Covey quote early on in that time. It's that parable where it's the two people at the axe and there's the one person just chopping and chopping and chopping, but there's the other person sharpening the blade, spending the time and to make it sharp, taking water breaks, taking rest, and really being strategic with how they go about chopping down that tree versus just wearing out the axe. What changed for me was just embracing this growth mindset of not just focusing on doing more, but doing what matters. And really, once I started to learn how to assess the landscape, figure out how to work, I got out of the everyday rigmarole of just working my tail off and started to shift into how to work smarter. And then once I really learned how to work smarter, I started understanding how to then work strategic and see around corners. And that's what really helped my career take off from the front lines, was taking that grit, that frontline work ethic, and understanding what it takes to do those jobs and applying that in a more strategic sense in each role I've got since then.
That's great. I think you really helped change yourself in some ways. You're agile, right? You were able to grow and learn from every experience. We've talked a little about this before because we've known each other for a while, but I think a lot of times organizations don't do a great job with career development for frontline team members, and they miss out on incredible talent like you. And I wonder from your perspective, Joshua, like what's missing when organizations think about career development for frontline team members?
In my experience, one being a frontline worker and now working with and supporting frontline workers as our customers for the last decade, I see two things consistently missing in career development. One, it doesn't exist. I would say that's a very common thing I've seen in quite a few companies or people that I talk to in other companies. Or two, the pathways for growth are not clear or accessible for all. So often we have frontline employees, they're so focused on their day-to-day tasks, they struggle to envision what's next for me. That was the big thing for me, right? I grew up that hard work was the only way to really a road to nowhere. I could never envision myself above the trees that I have this future where I can just be flying in the clouds and achieve all my career goals and dreams. And so without that visibility into how they can advance in the front lines, this sense of progression, it really becomes unclear for the employee, like what's possible. And I think that's a huge missed opportunity, not only for the employee, but the organization. And I just find often the root cause of that, the most important thing is we have many frontline managers and middle managers that have not been equipped with the soft or hard skills, really as their roles evolve from an individual contributor to a leader or from a leader of others to a leader of leaders. And they just take whatever their old playbook that they had in their pocket and try to apply it to this new level of leadership or this new level of work. And it just doesn't work. Many companies really hyper-focus on developing their high pos, which is fantastic. But really, you need to have some of that roll up your sleeves, get out in the field, get the voice of the employee and find out what they actually want. Not so much focus on the white papers and the Cliff Notes articles that tell you this is what they should be getting. And I think just for me, that's where I've really find is the focus goes to the top or the high potentials and the high performers, and everyone else kind of gets whatever scraps exist. So I think the better companies can focus on equipping people at all levels, obviously across the board, you're going to have a more dynamic and better performing workplace.
Yeah. I think when you talk about that, Joshua, it really kind of makes me think of the art of the possible, right? I think, mm-hmm. You know, people need to see that there's an opportunity at this company that I could go from an hourly team member or shift supervisor or a manager to other roles in the organization, maybe to corporate, et cetera. And I think, you know, companies like Walmart, you've seen this. I think the restaurant industry are really big. I'm sure at SRS, you guys were having a lot of those same successes. So I think that first piece is that art of possible, like showing people that. Mm-hmm. And the second piece you're making a really good point on is the leaders they work for also have to have that ability to see that talent, nurture it, and give that talent the opportunity. And so that's where you get into sort of systems and processes or really just empowering those leaders. Really good perspective on that. Helpful for people to think it through, because I think we sometimes don't talk enough about this. We really don't. One reason why I wanted you on the podcast was you are really doing a lot of innovative work, which we can't go too into, for a variety of reasons with an acquisition that happened at Home Depot. So we're going to be very light on that. But we could talk a lot about your approach. And you said that learning development should be simple, fun, and directly related to your job, which sounds painfully obvious, yet I don't think that always happens. Tell me more about why simple, fun, and directly related to your job guides your approach to L&D.
There's a quote from Albert Einstein that's always guided my approach, and I want to make sure people understand what I'm talking about so they're not confused of what simple means. But the quote is, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. So really the focus is on clarity, efficiency, and not oversimplification, with the result being losing meaning or actual functionality of whatever you're doing. And for me, simplicity means scalability. If you have simple things and not all these complex frameworks and theories and methodologies that we tend to get from books, and a lot of those books are written by people that have maybe never done those jobs, never led anything in the real world, then they might be researchers and it's great. And I think they serve a purpose. I've learned a lot of things from those books, but it becomes very impractical to go implement something like that in a 300-page book into an organization and deep into the front lines where that's not what they care about. I can attest to this. I could care less about, when I was a truck driver or a field tech, about whatever complex framework or methodology or pyramid that you want to show me in a PowerPoint. I just care about, how can you make my job easier? And what is the simplest way for that to occur? And I think the more simple, the easier the solution is to implement. And beyond complicating it with the frameworks, can we make it easy from how we speak to people? Are we speaking in simple language? Or are we using these big $20 words and all these buzzwords that many leaders in companies like to say that aren't really sticky, have no real substance, and aren't transparent? And then at the end of the day, fun drives engagement, and people should enjoy what they're doing. And I know that's, to your point, it is a novel thought, but I know you and I know I have sat through countless things that have been trainings or meetings or whatever they are, and they're painful to the point where I would literally rather be like shoveling holes in the middle of nowhere with no purpose than sitting in that room being bored to tears. And then I think in general, if you can create that engagement, obviously it's just going to make the learning stick more. When it comes to the last part of just in general, making things that are relevant to the job, no matter what we do, should have an exit ticket that equals, how does this make me better at whatever my role and responsibilities are for today? And also the future. Often we focus on stuff that current needs and gaps of behaviors and skills in the workforce, but also what are the future proofing skills and behaviors that we need to equip people with so that they can be successful. So that's my focus with my team. That's been my focus in each of the companies that I've led the learning function in, is just to really focus on how do we minimize friction and maximize the impact that we can deliver, and not just bring the new flashy thing that someone showed us at a conference to the table and try to implement that just brings in unnecessary complexity and most of the time ends up being a waste.
Yeah, I like that maximize impact and minimize the friction piece. I think that's really smart, Joshua. And so I love that approach, simple, fun, directly related to your job. I mean, we're being really pragmatic and practical. But what's your advice to L&D leaders on how to keep it real? How do you bridge the gap from theoretical to actually, I'm now implementing it and this is simple, practical, and fun?
Bridging the gap requires a deep understanding of the front line. If you want to go somewhere, you have to ideally have a map or have been there, right? You can't just wander upon some of these solutions. And I think many of us do that, where we just hope we'll kind of stumble on the way to unlock our frontline's productivity or lower attrition rates. You have to have a deep understanding of what they do, what their real life situation is. I know when I was making $10 an hour, living in a duplex in a low-income neighborhood with my wife, I'm not thinking about anything beyond just the next day. How do you bridge the gap of what is the real reality of whatever your frontline worker is and what their situations are? And how do you get out in the field? How do you shadow employees? How do you test solutions in real-world settings? Are you deploying things and don't even realize they can't access it because of the technology limitations they have? it could be Wi-Fi or not having a mobile device or not even having a computer, or maybe it's a shared computer. If you have the perspective of, I'm going to go into the front line. For me, I think I didn't have a corporate internship or something like that to get placed into a desk job. And that's how I spent my career. If they haven't done it, right? If you haven't done this frontline work, if you really want to bridge the gap, go do it. Beyond just shadowing, go figure out how you can work with your leader to get some like real life experience of like rolling up your sleeves, having people yell at you in your face, deal with the consequences of training not being good, and understanding the pressure that some of these folks have in different companies in their role, and really allow you to build the context that's going to matter. Because as people grow in their career, you get further and further away from the front line, which means you often get further and further away from like the root cause of what's going on, and more disconnected and more focused on doing those sexy things with technology that are not always meaningful. So if you can't get that experience, at the end of the day, you need to be making sure you're not creating learning in a vacuum. So even if it's not you, make sure your team is getting in the field, learning what those pain points are, and designing things, ideally with another frontline employee, like getting multiple frontline employees involved and finding way to co-opt these learning experiences that really allow you to have the right input and then create that kind of stickiness that truly moves the needle on performance and also can impact your ability to navigate change resistance, which often happens when we just come over the top with a solution without digging into what's really happening in the field.
Yeah, really well said. I think it's kind of an evolution from empathy and understanding, like I understand what a frontline member goes through, to experiencing it yourself. Then you have a little deeper level of empathy to where you're going, which is like, how do we co-create together to build better solutions that really will work in a variety of situations? Because I think that is the key. And I think almost all L&D leaders want to do that the best they can. Yeah. There's constraints around that, but I think really having that mindset, and it builds credibility, not only when you do that, but also when you start to actually implement, people are like, oh, you know, this is so great that we were involved and you tested it and you piloted it and it makes sense and it works. That just gets you a big win, especially if that is what you're focused on. The other piece I wanted to ask you about, Joshua, is that we'd love to hear more about maybe an example of an innovative learning solution that you've implemented in the past that you felt really moved the needle on performance. You've done a lot of innovative kind of learning development initiatives in your career, so we'd love to hear your best practices here.
Fundamentally, one of my favorite ones was, I was lucky enough to work at Verizon, which in my opinion is a top five learning organization in the world, thanks to their chief learning officer, Lou Tendrick, and ultimately the company's backing financially, leadership-wise, of just the importance of career development in all shapes and forms, whether it's formal career development programming or access to education outside of the company. It's really great. We did a hackathon for AR and VR probably back in 2017, really early emerging times of the technology. And so I was lucky enough to be a part of this, a small group that came up with the use cases for a store robbery training, which used VR in a really practical and applicable way that we were able to implement, and it created that emotional, oh my gosh, someone's pointing a gun at me. You're able to replicate these unsafe situations safely. And then we were also able to have a use case that we built and delivered in partnership with a third-party company for our field techs. And for me, that one was just like the store robbery geared around safety. So how do you go into these manholes? How do you climb a telephone pole? And what are the things you need to watch out for? Because at the end of the day, I did the field roles of DirecTV, and I also did it while I was at Verizon. Like, you can die on the job in these jobs. And when I was in DirecTV, we had someone die on the job while I worked there, because there's things that you just aren't always aware of how close danger is to you, whether you're on a 40-foot ladder, in a crawl space under someone's home, in an attic, on a roof with snow, whatever it looks like. You can die in an instant, but you can't really replicate those situations in a safe manner without some type of technology intervention. And so really, we were able to create these immersive learning and really realistic situations that allowed us to replicate those unsafe situations safely And the best part for us was you get great ROI from productivity, a safety, a dollar and cents, but you protect your employees, which are your most precious asset that you have. To me, that was probably one of my favorite early career. There's some really cool stuff that I have coming up that you're going to be doing with AI that I'm excited about. And we've already been experimenting this year, but that's probably one of my favorites from a innovation standpoint. Very cutting edge, ahead of its time. And honestly, still the gold standard for what companies have done when it comes to use cases with that technology to this day.
Yeah, great insights, really, really innovative training and learning doing VR and things like that. I hope that we do more of that in the future. It is cool because you can do something that's really unsafe and keep it in a safe environment. So I'm sure that the team members appreciate that and to have that experience. So we'll see how much more happens there. I definitely think AI, there's a lot kind of things that can open up with AI. And I think we'll see that space really blow up this year. Joshua, I did want to ask you, for early career HR professionals, maybe frontline team members who are interested in L&D, what experiences or skills should they be prioritizing in terms of their development?
For me, I think if you really want to truly build a career, so grow, let's say it's to becoming a chief learning officer one day or lead the talent function or whatever that looks like, you have to learn the business in a way that it allows you to deliver value as a strategic partner. In my experience, many people, not all, might even be most, in learning and development really struggle with the strategic partner aspect of it. They're very good at executing. They're very good at taking orders and going back into the business and just getting exactly what was asked of them done. And really, that's going to cause you to hit a wall in your career because you're going to struggle to know what matters to the business and then ultimately understand when do we need to pivot and how can I bring that in a proactive manner back to stakeholders to make a better decision that results in better outcomes. And I think it's really nice if you know Bloom's taxonomy and you know adult learning methodologies and you can measure with the Kirkpatrick or Phillips model, all those things are fantastic when it comes to learning and development. And many people I know are good at those things. But if you can't get scrappy and get programs out that meet the moment of need, it won't matter. Like it just will not matter. So I think if they can learn how to be a strategic partner and be really scrappy to execute things and then find the way to measure impact and not make the excuses, I don't have time or no one gives us the data. There's a way to measure it. I've figured it out every single time, even when it's difficult and might require you to do some work. I think what you're going to find is you will differentiate yourself from the sea of sameness when it comes to all the other people in the space that are doing a lot of the same things and just kind of being soldiers in a lot of way, which is like, here's my marching orders and I'm going to go do it. And then I think the final thing would just be pay attention to what's going on in the industry. Obviously, are there ways you can elevate experiences for the employees or your development programs in a practical way? And don't just do it for the sake of doing it, because a lot of things that you're going to find are going to be smoke and mirrors. They're not really going to provide any tangible value on the back end when it comes to ROI or productivity or performance. So if you can figure out what those things are and how they help unlock performance or unlock any type of really key attribute for your company, yet again, it's just going to be a really differentiator for you and really give you that kind of hockey stick growth in your career that a lot of people desire, but is pretty elusive for most people.
Great advice, Joshua. Appreciate that. Last question for you, Joshua, is what is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Human-centered workplace.
Human-centered workplace. All right. Well, you've heard it there. Joshua, thank you for sharing your story, your incredible career story, your insights around learning and development, keeping it simple, fun, and directly related to our job. It's been a pleasure having you on the Future of HR podcast. I appreciate it.
Thanks, JP.
What a great conversation with Joshua. It's a great reminder for all of us when we're designing programs to get into the field, talk to our employees, and design with them in mind. And of course, keep it simple, fun, and directly related to their job. Next is Peter from Providence Health. He's going to share his lessons learned in building a boomerang hire program that has netted over 5,000 hires over the last 2 years. Amazing results.
Peter, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being on the podcast. Thank you for being part of our Next Gen Disruptor series. You and the Providence team have had some great success hiring boomerang caregivers. Tell us more about why you and the team decided to focus on boomerang employees and how that's become a key part of your talent strategy.
For us, we always believed in the potential. It was already a strategy that was working. It was just, we were doing it on a much smaller scale. At Providence, we're a really large organization. The boomerang that campaigns that we were already doing were decentralized. So they were happening typically at the individual ministry level, which is what we call a hospital. We knew that if we wanted it to be even more successful, explore doing it on the enterprise level. Think about local boomerang outreach. It would be coming directly from a local leader where you had worked prior, and that can complement an enterprise outreach. But we identified the need to centralize as a centralized talent strategy, because frankly, we were missing opportunity to reach past employees. And so by centralizing it, we were ensuring that no past caregiver wasn't welcomed back. We were aiming to fill the gap there.
That's great. And maybe for a little context, how big is Providence now? How many hospitals, how many caregivers or team members do you have?
We're over 100,000. Our markets are in California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and a small footprint in Texas and New Mexico. So we're close to right around 50 acute hospitals. And then we also have many, many other lines of businesses, skilled nursing facilities, home hospice, clinics, et cetera. Pretty sizable employee.
Yeah, 100,000 is not something to sneeze at. And there's a lot of hospitals, which makes sense in why you want to have more of an enterprise view. And we'll talk a minute about how you did this and the work you guys did around Boomerang. But is it a focus on nurses and non-nurses? Like, who were you focusing on? What was the business case around trying to find Boomerang employees?
Nurses are always our number one hiring need. It wasn't just nurses, but I would say it is really the clinical patient-facing roles. Nurses, RNs, as well as medical assistants, certified nursing assistants, those are our core needs, as well as a lot of specialty areas. Diagnostic imaging is always a challenging role to fill, respiratory therapists. So the campaign wasn't limited to those roles, but the majority of hires that we make are in those roles. And to be honest, they're the core focus of this, because they're the ones that there's a talent shortage of those. So not that if you lose an accountant, you wouldn't welcome them back, but you'd open up a rec for an accountant, you might get 1,000 resumes, where if you open one for an RN for a difficult role, you might get zero for amount of time. So that really is the core focus of our needs. And really the team that I manage, we really focus on what we call priority hiring needs. So it is, most of our effort is heavily into those RN clinical patient-facing roles.
Really helpful. It makes a lot of sense that you would focus there in the skill gap and the talent shortage around nurses. So it's awesome you guys have come up with this innovative way to take this boomerang approach to get some hires back. But, you know, some companies have a negative view of rehiring employees. And maybe just talk more about Providence's approach and philosophy on this. Did you experience any pushback with the initial idea, or people just like, hey, Peter, if you can get us more nurses, we don't care where they come from?
It's a good point. I think we are unique, one, for the industry that we work in. I think in healthcare, welcoming back nurses is probably something most organizations would be happy to do. I didn't necessarily get pushback on it per se. I also think our culture is very welcoming, and I would also say re-welcoming as well. There are a lot of individuals that have worked here for many, many years, and there's a lot of them that left and came back. So being a boomerang here is not a stigma. It's almost like a lot of times people will share it with pride that they left and returned. One thing that I did need to confirm internally to make sure everyone was comfortable with it is really how we defined the audience and looking at our data. So I wanted to point out this is for voluntary term employees. So we're looking at all of those data fields and identifying who we absolutely know from that we would want to return. I think that eased some of the concerns if there were individuals that there wasn't the intent to be eligible for rehire. And we have so many data fields there that we even look at things like no show. So think of this like someone we hired, but they actually never started. We took the proactive approach to remove those. There may be some unique circumstances where that person something may have come up, but I would say we were fairly cautious looking at the data of who we wanted to include in this, because I'd rather be safe there. And it's still a sizable audience.
Yeah, I think that's right. So you're really making sure that you're getting folks that you want to come back, that didn't leave on bad terms or wasn't a no-show, which makes a lot of sense. But at your size, you have to scrub that data. It's not like, you know, you don't know every person's story individually. So I think that makes a lot of sense. You guys have had some great success with the program. You've actually had 2,600 Boomerang hires in 2023 and over 2,500 in 2024, which honestly, I think is truly incredible. I mean, that is a massive amount of Boomerangs coming back. Walk us through how this initiative evolved from a concept, these really impressive results.
One thing that conceptually from the very beginning, when we thought about this, we didn't want to view it as a one-off campaign. This was a ongoing effort. The idea is, and we really wanted to anchor it with content and storytelling. So think of it this way. When someone leaves, oftentimes, I mean, we all get them in the mail or outreach, like, oh, we want you back. But usually they don't really tell you why you should return. We approached it as we really wanted to treat it as a, to give some depth of what's new at Provenance. What are the reasons why you should consider returning, and really approach it as not just an invitation back, but a way to share with caregivers that used to work with, that were involved in the mission, how it's progressing, new things that we've done, how we've evolved, what new we're offering to our caregivers, and give them a reason to join. And also do it in a way where even if they're not ready to join, there's value in the communication, in driving them to a microsite with a bit of depth of people talking about why they're rejoining, talking about what we're doing, how we've continued to the mission, new things that are happening. So we wanted to make sure it was valuable, even if the person wasn't ready to, at that moment, to return and recognize that. And then we also wanted, knowing that this type of campaign, we're going to reach the same person likely multiple times, because not everyone's going to convert the first time. So we wanted them to, when they receive that second outreach, and we're doing it on a 6-month cadence, because I'm not sure the perfect timeline, but we didn't want to be too often or not often enough. So 6 months was kind of where we planted the seed. I said, we're going to do an outreach with every 6 months. We also wanted to make sure that enough had happened that we had a compelling story to tell. And sometimes it takes a while for new things to launch. So I think that has proven to be quite successful. From the get-go, we really looked at it as a marketing campaign, just versus a recruitment and an engagement campaign. In some ways, there's an alumni relations aspect to it as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting approach and way of thinking about this. And you mentioned a microsite. What is the first reach out? Is it a mailer, email? How are you reaching out to them to kind of say at the 6-month interval?
It's a great question.
Hey, we'd love you to come back to Providence.
Yeah, and as we've evolved this, we've learned a bit from it, and it may be different at different organizations, but the first time we did multiple types of communications to see which ones performed best. We did email, we did SMS, and we did direct mail to determine what was going to be the most effective. And what we learned was the text message approach significantly outperformed others. The way I think about that is, text is such a personal communication, and I don't think it's appropriate to someone that you don't have a relationship with. But I think these are individuals that worked for us. There's an established relationship, and you were able to reach them quickly that way, driving them directly to a mobile optimized website. So while we compared different combinations in our most recent iterations, we're exclusively using SMS. And it's also very easy to opt out of course. So if someone's not interested in receiving communications, with a single no, they can remove themselves from the campaign. There's been some of that, but it's a very, very small number.
I'm kind of curious on the numbers, because 2,600, 2,500 this year of Boomerangs is a lot. What was the total number of people you were actually reaching out to that were Boomeranged?
Roughly 60,000 that we're reaching out to that are in that database. It may change, because there's been some interesting findings in research of who's converted, but we went back 5 years and we waited 6 months. So if you left today, it'd be really odd to be like, come back, because you haven't really experienced what you've left for. They say that sometimes the grass is greener, but if you haven't experienced long enough. So we wanted to give enough time for them to really respect their decision as well, but not wait too long to make it clear that the door is open. And when we looked at the data of what converted, it was across the board. We saw a lot of success of individuals that had only left 6 months, others that had left a year or two, but there were quite a few conversions of individuals that had even left 5 years prior. So we may extend that a little bit further even.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's helpful. Thank you for being so candid with all the numbers. It's just interesting to think about this because, okay, 2,500, 2,600 out of like 60,000, I'm guessing it's the same pool, probably didn't change that much. So maybe you can combine the 60,000 and say we got about 5,000 out of 60,000. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. Over the course of 2 years, we're adding individuals. So it's fairly steady because we're not going past 5 years, and then we're adding individuals that have hit that 6 months leaving with each communication. So the total audience has been relatively steady. It might be going down a little bit because in healthcare, retention rates have improved slightly across the board. We're really thrilled that the numbers have stayed consistent from year one to year two. And it validates our belief that this should be an ongoing campaign. And it's okay if someone isn't ready today to make sure they know that the door is open. And if they love their job, we're happy for them. It's not pressuring in any way or look what you're missing. That's the balance that we're doing.
Yeah. When you add the numbers up, it's about an 8% conversion rate, which, you know, if you go look up email marketing or any marketing campaign, that is really, really pretty good actually for this outreach. And so I think you guys should be very proud of yourself. Any other secret sauce that sort of happens once I click, go to the microsite, kind of, wow, hey, Providence is up to some great things. Do they get a different experience as they go through the TA process? Is there any other things that happen that might be unique for someone who's a boomerang versus a new applicant?
Maybe down the road, but when we did this the first time, we actually set up a short form. So the idea is they could express interest and we would reach out to them right away. And we did that. And what we found is we actually get a much better conversion rate if we ask them to apply directly and get the process started and to view a job. We have a very, very efficient candidate experience that we leverage a lot of technology. It's so human-centered, but it's very efficient. And when we found that when they're ready, they're ready. But asking them to become a lead and have a conversation with us, it actually was a step that slowed things down. When we first kicked it off, we tested that. And then when we moved to put them directly into the driving them to a microsite, which had them apply similar to how an external candidate was, the conversions more than doubled. Sometimes adding that white glove experience can actually slow things down. And that was a unique finding. Of course, when someone reviews the resume, our hiring managers are seeing that they're a boomerang and they're very well qualified. So they're quickly getting through all of the screening questions into the right person.
I appreciate you bringing that up because I think that's interesting in some ways. Our initial thought might be, oh, let's give them a white glove experience and really make them feel special. But I think what you guys did by just having them reapply was you put a little friction in there and you made sure that people who applied were really interested. Like they weren't just, hey, let's just see if Peter's got a better job for me now. It was like, well, no, I really want to come back to Providence, right? Which probably helped you.
Yeah, so, I would agree.
What surprised you most about what former caregivers were looking for when considering coming back to Providence?
Interesting enough, after we've kicked this off, just in the last 3 or 4 months, we surveyed rehires that joined again. What was interesting is the reason they left is often the reason they return. It's kind of interesting when you think about it, and it makes you understand this audience is someone may leave for an advancement opportunity. They'll indicate that's why they left the organization, and then we'll ask them why they returned, and they'll say, for an advancement opportunity. So it's not a bad thing. I mean, sometimes that's just reality of how careers can happen. It could be opens that are available at a specific time, schedules. It's sort of while we want everyone to thrive within the organization, you recognize that sometimes it's timing. Welcome them back and career journey sometimes may involve leaving and returning as a part of that growth. We also found that individuals like indicated that they left seeking more work-life balance or wanting to experience a different culture. And those equally ranked with reasons that they returned. So sometimes it can be situational. If you're in a role, you may be in a specific role on a specific team with a specific manager or scenario. And we're such a big organization that there are so many different opportunities. Welcoming people back and them finding the right role that's a fit for them makes sense. I also think with culture and our mission is really a strength here. But if you look at healthcare organizations, and almost everyone will tell you why you should join is because we offer the best care because of the mission. I think it's a strength here that it's truly ingrained within the organization. Our history goes back hundreds of years where other organizations are much newer. I think it's an exceptional strength, and sometimes people may leave and then miss that shared bond and in the decisions that the organization are making, and attempt to find a different experience, a different culture, but sometimes it makes you appreciate one that you had worked in prior. So that was interesting. I thought there was going to be like a magic bullet of like, oh, this is why people are leaving and this is why they're coming back, and they're two very different things. It wasn't unexpected after I really thought about it, but sometimes as a marketer, you're looking for a really specific data point of like, oh, if we could only do better at this, they'll never leave. But the reality is sometimes you have to experience something different, or there's just a moment in time happening.
Peter, thinking about HR or TA leaders who are listening and want to start their own boomerang program for the first time, what are a few steps you'd recommend they take?
First, understand your data. And that was probably our biggest obstacle. We're a large organization, had grown through some acquisition. Our historical data was in two different HR systems, and they all had different categories of reason a person left, et cetera. So dive in, understand what you have to work with. I feel like there's always a path forward if you're willing to invest in understanding the complexity that was there, whether it's, you know, building crosswalks or pulling multiple files. So I would encourage any organization to really understand what they have and then develop a strategy and a path forward. For us, another thing that we did up front that I think helped make it quite successful internally was we thought about how we were going to report on it. And we built really, really detailed dashboards that not only said how many hires we made and how many people we were outreaching to, but we were able to segment it by different divisions and different regions. Because when the moment you're doing anything really, really big, a lot of your stakeholders really only care, not they only care, but they really care about their small piece of it. So from the beginning, we built it in a way where we could come back and be like, this additional boomerang campaign led to 2,600 hires. But if you're presenting that to a CHRO at an individual hospital, they're like, great. But how many of those hires did we make? Or even at the regional level, how many of those were in California versus Oregon? So we ensured that we built the data model so we could report on that. What's huge about that is we could tell them how important it was and how effective it was for them. And if there were some regions that were performing as higher than others, we could talk to them about that. Talk to them about maybe you want to consider doing a complementary local outreach from a leader there. So sometimes you celebrate success, and then you, by doing it that way, you can also identify opportunities. That's some advice I would give. And don't wait. Start. Like anything, you can get better over time, but what you can't get back is that missed opportunity. So it doesn't have to be perfect. You can learn a lot, continue to expand it, but start sooner than later.
Yeah, great advice. And I think people can learn so much from this entire podcast and what you guys have done at Providence. So Peter, thank you for going through that. Last question for you is, what's one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
What comes to mind immediately, just the word connected. I think it's that balance of automating, doing communications, but connecting all of the dots and making sure things are personalized and human. So I think there's a lot of automation still in HR, but it's usually, a lot of times it's a status update. It's one to many at many times, or it's indicating that someone's in this specific stage. I'm going to give them this update, but it's really about, I'm excited about identifying those micro moments. And we're doing a lot of work at Providence of, we use so many different systems, but we're investing in having them all connect. And I think historically that didn't always happen. And then when you look at that, the entire experience as one, I'm in HR, but I'm focused in the marketing. There's just so many opportunities of being able to reach people at the right time with something that matters to them based on something that they've done prior. And a lot of times it's timing. I think consumer marketing does a really good job of it, but their challenge is so different than ours, where they're trying to sell a product to someone that is willing to buy it. But we're trying to sell an opportunity at the right time to the right person. And then that opportunity isn't just what they bought, but what they do with it. And there is a right and a wrong person. And I think what we convey is infinitely more complex. I'm excited to see all of that, all those opportunities come together and even be able to look at it not only in the recruitment space, the full life cycle of an employee, and having employer branding equally as focused on talent acquisition as it is on employee experience and retention and growth. I'm excited about that.
Great. Well, I think connection is a great word, and you are definitely connecting to the boomerang employees from Providence. So Peter, thank you for sharing the story. Congratulations on all the success you're having. It was a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great conversation.
And with that, that wraps up our first Next Gen Disruptors episode. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Thanks again to Jennifer, Joshua, and Peter for being our first Next Gen Disruptors and sharing the great work they're doing. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Every Thursday, I'll drop in your inbox with one big idea that will get you thinking, two questions to challenge your perspective, and three actions you can take to level up your HR leadership game. Think of it as your weekly HR leadership booster shot, quick, powerful, and designed to help you put those ideas into practice immediately. So go to futureofhr.com and be sure to subscribe, and you can download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which has 18 pages of real-world advice from over 100 HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. And we'll be back next week with Jason LaRue, who's the National Managing Partner of Talent and Culture at KPMG. And in my conversation with Jason, he argues that organizations often over-index on skills development but underestimate the impact of employee well-being. We also dive into why he believes benefits can be a strategic asset and why KPMG is focusing on skills, not just jobs. This is a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.